Hi there, my name's Dave Doss. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
Boy, it's a privilege and an honor to be asked to stand up here and have a chance to share my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous with you. And I hope, if nothing else in this next hour, what comes across to you is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do believe it works. And we got the sign. They stole that sign from us, hanging in our in our home group. And hope is available here. And thank God, the message of recovery to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you're an alcoholic, man, it doesn't have to be that way ever again. And that hope is available here. And the best way I know how to share with you my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous is tell you about me. You know, I'm not an authority on the field of alcoholism. I hold no college degrees in that area. You know, I've got a few in some other areas you'll find about. But, And I'm not even an authority on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I have to share with you here this morning is just how AA seems to me, what my experience is. And I don't believe a blow-by-blow description of my drinking is why I'm standing up here today. I believe that what I'm up here this morning to share with you is recovery. But I'll share with you my first real drink, and so that you just understand that I understand what being an alcoholic is. And, I was 13 years old. And I'm not talking about, when I say my first real drink, I'm not talking about the first time I had a sip off of somebody's, you know, mom's pina colada or somebody's beer or something somewhere at a party. I'm talking about the first time I consciously took alcohol in my body and it did that magic. And I was 13 years old and I was loading tractor trailers and up in South Baltimore and we had gone down to Richmond, Virginia to do a job down there and I was loading trucks with furniture all day with these real men, you know, these truck drivers, man. You're going to find out a little bit about me. My father was killed in Vietnam when I was a kid, and I grew up without a dad, and I grew up being raised by a single mom, and came from a background. It wasn't, you know, I didn't have the best that life had to offer, but I tell you what, I was surrounded by love. I've always been surrounded by love. And these guys were kind of like my role model. I grew up watching guys like Clint Eastwood and John Wayne, you know, and that's the kind of drinker I was, a Clint Eastwood, John Wayne kind of drinker, you know, and these truck drivers, man, they were like my role models. I mean, they were the Clint Eastwood, John Wayne kind of drinkers, man. They worked hard, you know, they drank hard, and every now and again, one of them would just punch the other one, you know, just for no reason, you know. And it was great being around them, man. I was a little 5-foot-tall, 110-pound kid, man, and more than anything in the world, I wanted to fit in and be one of the men, more than anything in the world. And I worked as hard as I could that first day with those guys down there, and it was one of those days in Richmond like it is in Baltimore where it was, you know, 100 degrees and 99% humidity, and the back of the truck was 130 degrees. And you know, by the end of the day, man, we're all just drenched in sweat, and we've done a real job that day. We've really, really done some work. And these guys, they appreciated this little 5-foot-tall, 110-pound kid that gave all he had to give, you know. And they were sitting around. I'll never forget, they were drinking 16-ounce Budweiser cans, and the cool beads were running down the can. The condensation was just dripping down the can. And they're holding them, and one of the guys, it occurred to him, and he said, he looked at me, and he saw me kind of sitting off to the side, because I was sitting off to the side because I didn't quite fit in. You know, I was the kid. He said, "You've done the work of a man today, Dave." He said, "Why don't you have a beer with me?" He handed me one of them cold 16-ounce Budweiser cans. Now, I didn't take that beer because I'm an alcoholic. I took that beer because I wanted to fit in, because I wanted to be one of the guys. I didn't want to be a kid. I wanted to be a man. And I watched how they drank it, because I didn't want to be a lightweight, you know? I didn't want to be a lightweight. And I really believed that the way I drank that first beer wasn't alcoholic, you know. It wasn't alcoholic, like, to drink that first beer the way I did. But what I was trying to do is I was just trying to keep up with him. But see, something magic happened after about the second. It just seemed to go down inside of me and just seemed to just, you know, my sponsor says it goes boom. It goes boom and it comes up. And I tell you the kind of drunk I am. When it went boom and it came up, I just stood up. You know. And that's... I'm one of those animated alcoholics, man. When I'm ready to go. I don't know where we're going. I don't know what we're doing. But I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. And I tell you, the magic thing that happened is when I stood up, the 5-foot-tall, 110-pound kid became a 6-foot-2, 220-pound man. Shoulders out to here, rock solid, you know. And I went from being on the edge of the group to wanting to lead them. I didn't know where we were going with it. Let's go. Now, I don't think a non-alcoholic will ever understand that. I really don't. You can try and explain it to them, but they just don't get it. And you know what? My drinking that night was the way I always drank. I drank as much as I could. At some point that night, I had one of these things that you all described to me as a blackout. You know, I'm not a pass-out drinker. I'm a blackout drinker. I wish I was a pass-out drinker. Our book talks about a Jekyll and Hyde type drinker. That is me. There I am. You know, you let me drink enough, and boom, it's like throwing a switch. Here's this new guy. And I tell you what, even though I thought I was 6'2", 220 pounds, I was still a 5-foot-tall, 110-pound kid around these big, tough truck drivers. And they thought it was just comical, you know, that this, you know, little 5-foot-tall, 110-pound kid thinks he's a tough guy, you know. And they thought it was kind of funny and fun. And I woke up the next morning, and you know what I had? You know what I had that morning? The alcoholic fear. I woke up with. He's become a really good friend of mine later on, you know, constant companion. But I wasn't used to it. When I woke up with that fear, my God, what did I do last night? Somebody's thrown up on me. You know? Somewhere that night I got a hold of some slow gin and I wasn't sure whether I threw up or was bleeding. You know? Covering this red stuff and I traced it back and I figured out it came from me. You know? And I looked around, it was all over the room. But, you know, I did what I was taught to do or what I thought a real man does, and I got up, got cleaned up, and went back, finished the job. You know, what you do when you're afraid is you act tough, you act strong, you put on that shell. That's what I thought. You know, that's what I thought. And so that's what I did, you know. I put on that shell, and I acted tough, and I walked out into that hallway, and I saw one of those guys, and I kind of tried to straighten up, act tough, but I was wondering, what are they going to say, you know? And he gave me this big grin, you know, and he walked over and he slapped me on the back, almost knocked me down, you know. Because with these guys, that was like a rite of passage, man. I mean, you know, getting drunk and obnoxious and falling down and throwing up all over yourself, hell, you're just one of the crowd, man, you know. And if you'd asked me when I was 16 years old and like Thomas went and, you know, bought my first car with cash, because I had worked all those, you know, I'd been started working when I was all 13 years old in the summertime and worked hard, you know, because I was going to make something in my life. Like, Tom, when I got a charge of cars and clothes, there ain't no holes in my shoes this morning, I'll tell you that much. You know, and I come from the same kind of background. You know, God, but I am so grateful for that background. So grateful for that. And, you know, and that guy almost knocked me over, and it was like I was welcomed into the crowd, and what happened from then on is anytime there was any drinking, I was just automatically included in it. And if you'd asked me when I was 16 years old and I bought that car, you know, how did I get that car? I said, I got that car because I got a good work ethic. I'm a hard worker. And hindsight, the honesty of it is that I like to drink. And I tell you what, when you're 13 years old, and I lived down in the county outside of Baltimore in a little suburb, and it wasn't like everybody, all my little buddies at 12 or 13 years old were drinking. I'll tell you that much. And it wasn't like after after that experience in Richmond, it wasn't like I went to become a daily drinker. You know, it wasn't like that. But every time I had the opportunity to drink, that's the way I drank. You know, and one of the guys at the Tom Iyer, their sponsor, he talked about the rest of his drinking was like trying to get back to Richmond, you know. And that's what the rest of my drinking was like. It was like trying to get back to the way I felt when it first did that magic, you know, without any of the consequences. Without any of those consequences. Without having to pay any price. The magic without the price. That's what I was in search of, you know. And that's what we've got here. We've got the magic. We've got the magic. Boy, there isn't any price. There isn't any price. Not like that. And you know, what happened is from the time I was about 13 to I was 19 years old is a slow decline of everything that I thought was decent and worthwhile in my life. It was a slow decline of who I am and who I thought I should be as a man. You know, all the decent principles that I was taught. I can't stand up here and tell you that I wasn't taught right and wrong. You know, guys like Tom know my family. God, I come from quality people. I come from people who are shining examples of how to be a good human being and have never been in this program. They take the principles of the 12 steps and they live them in their life effortlessly every day. And these are the people that I was raised by, man. I was taught about honesty and hard work. I was taught about giving. I was taught about getting out of yourself and helping another. I was shown it. I wasn't told it. I was shown it. And I knew that's what I wanted to be. That's the kind of man that I wanted to be one day, was a man like my grandfather. But it just seemed like I had such good intentions, but I get to drinking, and I just couldn't quite get there, you know. And by the time I was 19 and I came to you, I stood in the mirror with a gun in my mouth, ready to blow my brain. And what had happened is, you know, if there was a line, one of those sort of invisible lines that they talk about that we cross with our alcoholism, I was about 18 years old, and my alcoholism went from drinking the way I drank when it was offered to me seeking it, to me saying, I just can't wait for the weekend. I need to go out and get it. I can't wait. I got to do it now. You know, and it began to start costing me, you know, the simple human dignity, the self. It began to start costing me my dreams. I began to make decisions based on my alcoholism. It would affect the rest of my life. I had a chance to go to one of the best schools in the country for the field that I was interested in studying, and I turned it down. And you know why? I turned it down because I was afraid. And the reason I was afraid, because I knew that my alcoholism was catching up quick. And I knew that if I got away from the people who were holding me together, that I would come apart at the seams, and it wouldn't take long. You know, it started dictating what I would do, where I would go, who I'd spend my time with, and what I would do for the rest of my life. And I knew that. And I could feel it begin to strip away. I had made a bunch of promises to myself, things that I would and wouldn't do. I had drawn all these lines in the sand. I didn't realize high tide was coming. I didn't realize high tide was coming. And you know, I'm one of these people, and I don't know, different people are different ways, but all my life, it's really never mattered a whole hell of a lot to me what other people think about me. I mean, that's just my personality. I've never really cared a whole lot. But I tell you what got my attention is when I started crossing my own lines that I had drawn. When I started doing things that weren't acceptable for me. It never mattered if somebody else said, you shouldn't do that. But when I said to myself and looked at the things I had done and said, man, I can't believe you did that. That got my attention. That got my attention. When I walked in at 19, I started off seeing a psychiatrist and a psychologist long before I came to you. And so I was so grateful when I read this big book and I found that alcohol is but a symptom of our disease. And I thought, whew, thank God. Because I got some serious problems. They go way back. I've been this way as long as I can remember, you know? And it's true. You know, it is true in my case. And I sit behind these desks of these guys with diplomas on the wall. And I tell you what, in the 70s, it wasn't fashionable. You know, and I didn't tell my other little buddies I was going to see these guys. You know, and they showed them funny-looking ink blots across the desk and asked me what I thought. You know, and I tell you what, when I was in school, I was a good student in any school I ever went to, but when I get into some trouble, and I got into some trouble, they send me down the office, and my file, and I get in a fight with a kid, you know, I don't know why, just because, and they send us down the office, and they pull out the files, and the kid I got in a fight with file was this thick, and mine was that thick. I didn't know it was in that file, but I knew I was different. I knew I was different. I was treated different. And I tell you what, you know, I've been to church. I was raised in church. I knew God as my father and knew God loved me. And my father got killed in Vietnam when I was a little kid. My mom had grown up telling me that he was in heaven with God. So God very much loved my father. And I was always taught that my father loved me, and I saw the pictures of him holding me and heard the story of how much he loved me. And if my God was up in heaven, then my God must love me because my father's up in heaven. You know, that's the concept of God I grew up with. That's what I heard in church. I'm fortunate. I grew up in a church where I didn't hear about a punishing, scorekeeping God. But I tell you what, when I was about 13 years old and started taking that drink, there was a whole different set of principles in my life that I knew didn't go along with these principles that I had been taught in the church. And it wasn't that I never stopped believing. It's just that I thought that it was just time for God and me to part ways. You know? And no matter how far it seemed that I drifted off, I had a feeling he was over there, that shadow on the stage. He's always called to me. Called to me as a child, as I'm sure he has many of you. I was one of these kids that grew up staring up at the trees in the woods, laying on my back on a beautiful spring day, almost being able to feel that there was more to me than this physical shell that's on the outside, almost knowing that there was something beyond it. You know, he's always called to me, and even in the depth of my alcoholism, he called to me. So I was exposed to psychology and psychotherapy and best the medical profession had to offer. You know, and I was brought up with a loving God in a wonderful church and surrounded by people who practiced those principles. I had tons of people that loved me and my family and a host of friends. I had all these things around me. And at 19 years old, I got a gun in my mouth, standing in front of a mirror, ready to pull the trigger. And I'm shaking and I'm crying and I'm cursing myself for a coward because I can't pull the trigger. And our big book talks about a jumping off place where we wish for the end. We can't imagine life with alcohol anymore, and we can't imagine life without it. We come to the jumping off place. And the thought occurred to me that a year before that, I had buried a grandfather. And that grandfather had died with 15 years of sobriety. Let me tell you about the example in Alcoholics Anonymous. set for me. At the end of his life, he was on oxygen. At the end of his life, he really hardly ever got out of the house. But for some reason, twice a week, I didn't understand why until I came to you. He would take all that he had. And my grandfather's from the old school, as I've been taught, that when you show up to a meeting, you show up looking respectful. You show up carrying yourself as an example of the program of respect and simple human dignity that Alcoholics Anonymous is. And it would take him half a day, literally, to very slowly, one little, very small step at a time, get himself cleaned up, shaved, dressed, to go to an AA meeting. And he would spend the time with you all, and he would come over, and he would be wiped out for a whole another day or two, and he'd repeat the process twice a week. And I used to look at him and wonder, you know, what is wrong with him? Why does he do this to himself? And today I know. See, I knew when I stood there with that gun in my mouth that there was maybe just one more place for me to try. The only place I could think of, I'd been everywhere else. And the thought came to me that maybe, just maybe, I would have come down to Austin Island. And I walked to my first meeting. I was 19 years old. The legal drinking age was 21. I was still in college at the time, although things were falling apart pretty quickly, but I had made the dean's list the semester before. I had a brand new Mustang in the parking lot. My little blonde cheerleader girlfriend came to the meeting with me, and my grandmother went across the hall to Al-Anon. See, the point that I'm making is there was still some stuff on the outside, and I was kind of trying to hold that shell together, although the night before I stood in front of the mirror with a gun in my mouth, you know? And it's amazing how quickly the alcoholic ego recovers. The night before, I'm standing there with a gun in my mouth, and the next day, I'm at an AA meeting, already beginning to compare myself out with you sick people. Already beginning to say, oh, I'm not that bad. I mean, I can look around the room, and I was by far, by at least 10 years, probably more like 15, the youngest person there, by at least. And, you know, and they asked if anybody was new. And there was some other people that raised their hand and said they were alcoholic. And my girlfriend, with them elbows in the ribs, you know. And I just said, I'm Dave and I'm an alcoholic. And that wasn't hard for me to say. I suspected that I was an alcoholic long before I came to AA. I knew I didn't drink like other people. And you know how you can always tell that? If you drink with some people, and I drank with some people who drank. I mean, like, we'd stay up all night, a couple days at a time and drink. And when those people pull an intervention on you while you're drinking with them, it's a pretty clear sign that you're different. And I can remember distinctively, there were these four or five guys, and we were like tight, man. We were everywhere. You know, we were tight. And we're driving down the road about 4 a.m. after, you know, we're just hammering them down, and they bust an intervention on me and say, you know, we've been meaning to talk to you about your drinking. You know there's something wrong when the people you're drinking with are trying to intervene on your drinking. And so I suspected that I was an alcoholic, and I didn't have any problem saying that. But I didn't realize for me to stay here, for me to get recovery, what followed. What would follow? The level of commitment, the level of dedication, the level of surrender in order for me to stay here with you. And after that meeting, one of these old gray-haired guys came up out of the meeting, you know, they just look for people like me, you know. and he came up to me, and we talked for a few minutes, and he said, Dave, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, son. He said, but I promise you one thing. If you're an alcoholic and you keep drinking, it'll get worse and you'll die. And I thought, whoa, you don't understand who I am. I'm 19. I'm an honors college student. I'm in good, outstanding physical health, probably better than I am now. And you don't understand. Of course, the night before, I'm standing there with a gun in my mouth. You know, I mean, but I forgot that in that short time. And I really, it was the first time somebody had introduced to me the concept of alcoholism being progressive and fatal. You know, I mean, I kind of knew it intellectually, kind of in the back of my mind. But thank God for the keen alcoholic mind. Now, you notice the only people you hear talk about the keen alcoholic mind are the alcoholics. You know? I had a girlfriend who, if you asked about the keen alcoholic mind, she said, yeah, the keen alcoholic mind peed in the corner on my radio the other night. You know? And that's the kind of alcoholic I was, you know. And, you know, you hear about the keen alcoholic mind. And so what I did is I did the math, right? And you'll find out later that, you know, I've been a student most of my life, and through sobriety have taken that to a whole new level of incompetence. This guy I was talking to, from talking to him, I figured he was there about 10 years, you know, just a pretty good estimate. And he looked like he was probably about 60 to me, which meant he got sober when he was 50. 50 minus 19, which is how old I was, is 31. That meant there were 31 years between where I was and when he got sober. That's a pretty long time to drink. And I was one of these, you know, one of these alcoholics that, you know, I had read the books Under the Influence, and I could tell you about tetrahydroisoquinoline and how my body metabolized alcohol different than normal. I remember sitting to my psychiatrist and said, yes, I recognize after reading this book that you suggested that I have the potential to become an alcoholic, but as of yet, I am not one. Thank you very much. You know? So I knew about alcoholism, the disease, but I didn't know that it kills a lot of young drunks. Like before, I got a gun in my mouth. But yet by the next day, the arrogance and that ego had returned to the extent that I couldn't accept help. And that started a period of 3.5 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sure from Tom last night, who's a first nighter. And he'll tell you he's a first nighter because he used up the second and third nights before he got here. I hadn't used mine up yet. I wasn't convinced. Our book talked about getting convinced. You know, our book talked about stepping up the barroom and trying to... I used to get to that point in the book and I'd go try it. A lot. I mean, you know, I read this book. I mean, I right from the get-go, I got the book and I started reading it. And I get to that point where it said, if you are not convinced, I said, I'm not convinced, let's go. And I was. And I don't know how many times I repeated that experiment. You know? But it just kept getting worse. You know, kept getting worse. And I kept coming back to you. And God, it's a miserable experience. Coming and spending some time with you all and seeing your joy. And knowing you've got it, I've seen the people like Tom and Virginia back there. Virginia, you know, I was telling somebody before the meeting, and I walked in at 19 trying to project this tough, you know, gun-carrying, street drunk to this lady, and she just looked at me, and I could see the compassion, and she just reached up and hugged me. And get away from me, you old woman, you know? And what would happen is I would drag my sorry butt back to you all. People like her would look at me with those eyes of compassion, never judge me, and would welcome me back. And say, oh, honey, I hope you're done. Oh, honey, I hope you're done. You know, and that's what she did for me, and I kept coming back. And I tell you what, the horror of that is what you do to the people around you. The family that I had that loved me so much. In that 3.5 years, I wound up at a treatment center, and this will give you a picture of the kind of love that I have and the kind of family that I have. On visiting day, Sunday was visiting day, and I'm at this treatment center outside of Washington, D.C., you know, and it's 60 miles one way from where I live. And, you know, there are people at that treatment center who didn't have anybody come to see them on Sunday. I had 14 people show up to see me. 14 people. Lack of love was not my problem. Lack of love was not my problem. And I can remember, that touched me then. I mean, I'm not without a heart, you know? But people out there think we're without hearts, but we're not. God, part of the reason half of us get here is because we just can't take it anymore on the inside. We're taught too well. We know we're not supposed to live this way. Not to live the way that alcoholism dictates. But we just got to come. We got to end it. It's got to end. Yeah. And some of us stop in this life. Some of us will stop in the next, but it'll end. When I stood here with that gun in my mouth, I knew it had to end. You know. And in those 3.5 years, I came and I sat in those chairs. And there's a pamphlet around called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was what that pamphlet described in a section of it where it says, there are people who come back to AA day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, waiting for the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous to rub off. And it follows up by saying what rubs off is rigor mortis and death. Ooh, strong language. Strong language. It's true. It is true. As much as we'll share in this weekend with the joys of being in recovery, let us never forget what lies out there is misery and death. Let's never forget how serious our sobriety is, but not take ourselves too seriously, you know. And that's what I did. It says in that pencil, what we hope rubs off is the alcoholic's willingness to act, the willingness to take action. And I want to tell you about the end of that 3.5 years. I was sitting in a meeting, getting ready to get a 24-hour chip. I had just been through the treatment center, had put together one day short of 6 months, had drank twice on antabuse, and was really beginning to believe that I wasn't a high-bottom drunk. Really beginning to believe that. And I just didn't know what went on. I swear to God, I was baffled by it. I mean, you know, I went into treatment center like I went into a college course. And by the end of that 30 days, I was, you know, elected the leader of the group of nuts. You know, only a nut can think it's a privilege to be a leader of a group of nuts. But I really thought I had it. You know, I really did. And, I had identified my triggers. I had a relapse prevention plan in place. I could show you where I was on the Jelinek curve. Here I am coming back up. Taking my antabuse pill on schedule. And went to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I, for some reason, I just missed what's read at so many meetings. Here are the 12 steps which are suggested as a program recovery. And what the point I want to get to is I'm sitting in the back of that meeting, and I've got one day, and I'm getting ready to get that 24. And it's one of these meetings, like, it's bigger than this. It's a couple hundred people, and there's, like, two home group members. You know? My sponsor calls them John Wayne meetings, where they're coming wearing their little yellow bracelets because they're coming. It's in a hospital, and they're coming downstairs from the ward upstairs, you know? And what happened was is this guy stood up at a podium and he shared about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as a program of recovery. And I believe that God gives all of us a moment where the clouds just seem to part and the truth just comes in and grabs a hold of our heart. And we know it. For some reason we know it. And that night it was like, and Bill talked about it, like a fog settled over the room and there was just he and I. And we were separated by a great distance and a lot of people. And they asked if there was anybody who was new, and they asked them to come and get their chips. And I walked up, and I got that 24-hour chip. And I went way to the back of the room and sat down. And I want to tell you a little bit about people like my sponsor and the kind of sobriety that I've been introduced to and hopefully now have the opportunity to pass on. When that meeting was over, hundreds of people in this room, hundreds of people. And you know, with that sort of combination of pride and combination of lack of self-worth that an alcoholic has when they come in, I didn't want to walk up and ask this guy for help. But I felt drawn, you know. And as I began to very slowly walk up through the crowd of people, and these guys, he's surrounded by people, all wanting to talk, blah, 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 and he's looking for me. Because you could see the pain in my eyes. You could see, maybe I might be ready. And finally, I went up to him, and here's the way a guy like me asks for help. I know you're busy. And I had seen this guy. This is one of the guys I had seen around. Every time I come back, he was there, and he was happy. And he had sponsored a guy that I went to school with, and it went like this with this guy, is that I'd have a month, and this guy would have a day. And next time I seen him, he'd have a month, and I'd have a day. And it went like that for years, and he's still out there doing it like that. Still out there doing it. And so I knew this guy, and I said, I know you're busy, I know you work with a lot of people, but maybe, possibly, do you think we could get together in the next month or two and talk about these steps? Because I just, there was something about, it's like a light bulb went off. They're like, that's what I didn't do. That's what, I did all this other stuff that I thought was A, but I didn't do that. And he's saying that's it. The other stuff is nice on top of this, but that is it. If you want to recover from the disease of alcoholism, we have a program. It is the 12 steps. We don't have another program. It says in this book, here are the 12 steps which are suggested as a program recovery. There is not an appendix in the back that says, if you do not like suggested program A, turn to the appendix in the back of the book for suggested program B, for those of you who are not willing to try to live by spiritual principles. And what he introduced me to was simply what I just said in that pamphlet. What are you willing to do? And I asked him, I said, you know, do you think maybe in the next couple months? And he said, whoa, whoa, whoa. We get the whoa, whoas when we're new with my sponsor. And whoa, whoa, whoa. He said, do you have a car? And I said, yeah. He said, here's my card. It's got my number on it. Can you meet me at this place tomorrow night at 7 o'clock? And I said, yes. That was it. He said, I'll see you then. If you can't make it, call me. That was it. No discussion of my wounded inner child. He didn't even want to see my relapse prevention plan. And I showed up at a Denny's in Glen Burnie. And I met this group of men. And they had the shiny eyes that Tom talked about last month. The guy that I had asked to help me was sober 9 years. 9 years was an eternity to me. Couldn't imagine 9 years. But there were men there who had 3 months, 6 months. His eyes were shining. I had had 3 months and almost 6 months. I never felt like they looked. I was hanging on. And it was very clear that what they had done was let go. And I became attracted to this group of people. I knew they had an answer. Couldn't deny it. I really believe that when a student's ready, the teacher will appear. But I wasn't convinced. There was still a reservation. I spent a couple months with these people, and I was convinced more than ever that they had the answer. And I wound up in Tijuana, Mexico. I like to get drunk and go places. But here's what shows me the power of the disease. And I went out to California, and I was stone cold sober. And physically sober as I'm standing here tonight. And I asked my sponsor, I had this trip planned, and he said, you can go anywhere on the face of this earth. You know, we're free men. You can go. When you get out there, call AA, get the meetings, read your big book, pray, you'll be fine. I got out there, I had jet lag. You know, going the wrong way, but I had jet lag, right? And long and short, it was after 2 weeks, I hadn't gone to any meetings. And after 2 weeks, the insanity returned between my ears. And I found myself in Tijuana, Mexico, and the spiritual experience, you know, came upon me that I'm not an alcoholic in Mexico. When they talk about a strange insanity in the book, they mean it's a strange insanity. I'm physically sober, have gone through the ringer in the last 3.5 years, but somehow I'm not an alcoholic in Mexico. And guess what happens when you're not an alcoholic in Mexico? You drink. That started a period of 2 weeks. Oh, God, that was a horrible 2 weeks. Wound up locked up for assault and battery. No big deal. Been there before. Wound up wrecking another car. No big deal. Been there before. Had a girl in my life, and I love this girl, man. She went through the hell with me. And the tears were running down her face, and she stuck her finger in my chest and said, "You'll never change. You'll never change, and I'm sorry I ever met you." And I knew I was past being able to blame her or anybody else in my family. I knew it was me. I knew if you loved me, you paid a hell of a price. I knew those tears were put there by me. And I thought to myself, God, I wish you'd get the hell away from me and find yourself a decent man. You deserve better than me. Because I knew she was right. I knew I would never change. A couple of days later, I found myself in a hospital bed. I'm 22 years old. I got in a fight with a guy, a friend of mine. You all might have had some friends like this. Over who would go sit in the front seat of the car on the way home from the bar. I started it. Because obviously he didn't know who the hell I was. He even suggested I sit in the back. And the long and short of it was that the best that we can piece together is the side of my head got caved in on a concrete pole. And I came to, I'm 22 years old, I'm laying in a hospital bed dying. Blood's coming out of my ears. The doctors are telling my family if he doesn't die, he'll be a vegetable the rest of his life. And they're not telling me nothing I didn't know. I'm like Tommy, I love bar rooms. Oh, God, man. Fast cars, bright lights, action drunk. Before I was 20 years old, I had been in more than 100-mile-an-hour car accidents. Before I was 20 years old, I had been shot at, I had been stabbed. I got some fake teeth up front, thank you for eating too much candy. Okay. It's before I'm even legal to be there. And so I know what it's like to come to in the hospital and not be able to see out of your eyes that are swollen shut. I know what it's like to come to being all busted up and getting stitched back, put back together. But I tell you what, when I came to and I'm laying in that bed, I know it's different. By then I was almost dead. I almost bled to death. Blood was coming out of my ears. And I could feel it was cold. It was cold. And I was scared. Scared like I've never been scared before since. And I'll tell you the reason I was scared. I'll tell you the reason why laying there, I didn't want to die. Just because I didn't want to die that way. You know? I didn't want to die knowing that my life had meant nothing. I didn't want to die knowing that the way I was going to step off this earth was to hurt the people that loved me one more time. I didn't want to die knowing my life had no value, had no purpose, that I hadn't done what I thought God had wanted me to do, which is somehow make a mark here, to somehow make this place better. Somehow there was a purpose, and I had sensed it from the time I was a kid. And I lay there with the blood running out of my ears, dying. And I pleaded to a God that I didn't believe would help me. Please, not to let me die as well. My grandfather, and it was one of these deals when I was in the hospital, I'd be conscious for 2 minutes and out for 2 hours. And I came to, and my grandfather's holding my hand. And this, my grandfather's probably the shining example of my life that I try to live up to. He's still alive today. And he's one of these tough guys from the old school, you know. And I've only seen him cry once in his life, and that was when we buried his mother. And I'm looking up at him, and I'm looking into his eyes, and I'm asking him if I'm going to die. And I didn't know the doctors had just told him it didn't look good. They didn't expect me to live. And I saw a tear run down his cheek. And I knew the answer. I knew the answer. And I heard a man say once, dying men, don't pray, dying men, please. And I pleaded to that God that I had known so long ago, that I drifted so far apart from. Please, please, don't let me die this way. Please don't let me die. Now, I didn't get the Bill Wilson cool mountaintop peppermint patty wind through my gut experience. I didn't get a bunch of people with a dozen donuts and a cup of coffee dragging me out of the hospital room, taking me to the AA meeting. What I got is I came through the next day and I wasn't dead. And a friend of mine is no longer with us. Died sober and alcoholic anonymous. Said he felt like he was less than nothing. He felt like a zero with the rims rubbed off. And that's what I felt like when I came to you, laying in that bed, still bleeding out my ears, still not knowing how I was going to live or die, getting shot up with morphine every couple hours because the pain was too intense. By now I'm paralyzed, laying in the bed, and I'm vomiting on myself. And the sadness of it is that I've become so powerless physically that I can't even turn my head. And so as I get sick and vomit on myself, the nurses have to come in and strip me and dress me, you know, and then come in and do it a couple hours later. And that's the way my first night of sobriety went. Here's the beauty of it. Here's the thing I don't ever want to forget. Here's where you come in. Again. That morning, I'm laying in the bed with the voices talking to me. You know the voices? Man, you've really done it this time. Boy, look at you. Look at you. You've really done it this time. And begging for when I get that morphine shot, because when they give me that morphine shot, I wouldn't have to be conscious and feel the pain of what was going on between my ears. It wasn't the physical pain. Alcoholics are incredibly tough. Incredibly tough on the outside. It was what was left on the inside, which my sponsor was talking about last night. Clearly bankrupt. Nothing left. Nothing. And this guy walked in the room. It's that same guy that I'd seen. The same guy that stood up at the podium and told me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at the 12 steps. And I want to tell you about men like my sponsor. I don't ever want to forget what was done for me that day. He had read this book. And in this book, in a chapter called Working with Others, and I hear people say all the time, I don't know how to work with someone. I don't know how to 12-step people. There's a chapter in the book that tells you. Right in the book. And he had followed the suggestions in that book. After I went out to California and he didn't hear back from me, he called up. And I guess he probably got my grandmother or somebody. He said, look, I haven't heard from David in a while. How's he doing? And she probably said, oh, he's drinking again. And he said, look, let me tell you something. Here's my number. Here's my phone number. There may come a time when he's ready, and you'll know it. When that time comes, you call me, and I will come. And that time came, and she called him, and he came. Now, what would have happened to me if he wouldn't have come? I don't know. I may not be standing here tonight. All I know is that when I needed Alcoholics Anonymous, and someone called, you came. You loved me more than I loved myself. You cared more for my life than I cared for it. you value my life more than your own, because you're willing to lay yours down for the time that it would take for you to drop what was going on in your life and bring it to a guy like me, more dead than alive. And that's what he did. And he walked through the room, and I'll never forget, he opened the door, and he looked at me, and the whole side of my head was smashed. I was paralyzed. There were tubes and hoses shoved in me, and blood was still trickling out of my ears. And he looked into my eyes, and a look of compassion came over his face. And I know today, because I've seen people that have the kind of pain that I must have had in my eyes, that kind of emptiness, that kind of lack of a soul. Lack of a soul. And he walked over, and he took my hand, he took his hand, and he put it on my shoulder, and he said, "David, it doesn't ever have to be this way again." And that was June 23rd of 1990. And from that day to this, I've never had a day anywhere near like that again. And let me tell you what was done for me. Let me tell you the kind of people that I was fortunate enough to get involved with in Alcoholics Anonymous. People began to come to the hospital and see me. They began to bring meetings into me at the hospital. I was in there a couple weeks, and finally they decided that I probably wasn't going to die. I stayed paralyzed. They sent me home. I didn't have that good of insurance. So they sent me home. I was home a couple days, and there was a knock at the door. And I don't know about you, but when I was sober, you know, just a couple weeks, I didn't like knocks at the door. I wasn't in any condition to defend myself. And the kind of drunk I was is you never knew who was knocking on the door. And my grandmother walked into the room that I was laying down in, and she said, "There are some people here to see you." And there must have been a look of terror that came across my face. I mean, I didn't say anything, but it must just have been a look. I probably went white as a sheet, because I'm like, "Oh my God, who's here to see me, and what do they want?" And she said, "It's okay, honey, they're from Alcoholics Anonymous." And it baffled me. What are they doing here? What are they doing here? And she helped me up, and I could barely walk. The side of my face hung down like I had a stroke. And she helped me up, and she guided me into the dining room, where there sat four members of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of which was my sponsor, still my sponsor today. And the other three were much newer, under a year. We report all those men are sober. You know, some of them been in and out. All of them were sober. And I sat down at the table with them. And let me tell you what happened at that table. Up until that point, I was hopeless. Up until that point, even though people were coming, like my sponsor, coming into the hospital room, trying to pass on to me, up until that point, I really knew in my heart that it was only a matter of time if I lived before I would get up out of that bed and I would drink again. I knew alcohol had beaten me. There was no doubt in my mind of myself and by myself. I cannot keep from taking a drink when I walk through that door today. Of myself and by myself, I still cannot keep from taking a drink. And as I walked out and I saw these men sitting at the table, it just made such a profound impression on me. And I just sat down. I couldn't tell you a word of what they said. I couldn't tell you what kind of car they drove in. I couldn't tell you what clothes they were wearing. All I know is that what happened sitting at that dining room table was that I was given a spark of hope. Spark. Not a blinding light. Spark. And the spark was simply this. Maybe, just maybe. Maybe, just maybe, if I do what they're doing. Maybe, just maybe, I doubt it, but maybe, I might get what they've got. And I tell you what, sitting there at that table, I looked into their eyes, and I've always wanted to be the kind of man that they were and are. I wanted to make a difference. It was clear to me, these men were taking time out of their lives. For me, for a bum like me that knew he was going to drink again, for what? For what? Guys like my sponsor came to that hospital with 9 years sober, put aside whatever was going on in his life. For what? I know what today. Because he owes, and I owe, my life to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the condition for me to stay here is that I'd be willing to go to any lengths to pass on what was given to me the way it was given to me. I don't get to water it down. I don't get to say I'm too busy. I don't get to say I've got a mileage limit on how far I'll go to do something, or a time limit. I don't get to do those. The saying in my house, you'll hear more about. We got a saying in our house, my wife's in this program too, is character over comfort.
She and I are both very active now, Hawks, and we got a little girl. Our lives are packed full. But I tell you what, we got a calendar on the refrigerator. If somebody calls and says, can you do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, and there is nothing on that calendar, yes. That phone rings any day, any time, day or night. You need to come. I'll be there. No questions asked from either one of us. People she sponsors, call any time, day or night. People I sponsor, call any time, day or night. If you need us, we're there. Very simple. I was taught that. I was shown that. I try to pass it on as best I can. So what's happened in the last 10 years? God. Transformations in my life are just incredible. I'll start off with the early ones and go on through the day. First thing that happened to me was I was sober 3 months. I just got with this group of guys, and I just started going. And it, you know, and they brought meetings to my house. I couldn't drive a car. Just here's this one guy. I got to talk about Mike. Miss Mike. He was laid off. He had an old beat-up pickup truck. I was still paralyzed. He'd come down the house 2-3 times a day to pick me up and take me to the meeting. Mike didn't have a lot of money. Mike had a family. Mike was only sober about 9 months. He started dragging me around the meeting. And I can remember Mike had taken me. I lived like 20 minutes from Mike one way. And he'd drive 20 minutes out of his way, pick me up, take me to a meeting. There wasn't any meeting near my house. He'd drive another 20 minutes back to the day. And I can remember trying to give him some money for gas and him not taking it. And he looked down at me, and I'll never forget him looking over at me and saying, you're helping me more than I'm helping you. And he said that to me. And I looked up at him and I'm paralyzed. He said, how am I helping you? You know? And he said to me, one day you'll know. And pass it on. It's the message I have here tonight, if anything. I've been given a lot to Alcoholics Anonymous. And every now and again, you know, it's been times in my life when my sponsor's been there for just about every major event in my life. I'll hug him and tears will come in my eyes. And I want to thank him. I want to thank him for what he's done for me. And to say to me, pass it on. That's what I do my best to do, is just try to pass it on the way it was given to me. And I became willing to go through the steps. I became willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober. I came to you a beggar, begging for you to give me what you had. And 10 years later, I haven't become a chooser. I still walk through that door begging for you to give me what you have. I don't ever want to forget that when I came to you, I had nothing. And it seems like now I have so much. I don't ever want to forget what the magic ingredient in that formula is. It's you. It's you. Because you spoon-fed me this program. You showed me the program. You know? Guys like my sponsor said, I'm not going to tell you how to work the steps. I'm going to show you. Come on, walk beside me. I won't lead you and walk 10 steps in front of you. Take my hand and I'll walk beside you. I've been down this path before. I can show you where the pitfalls are. And I can show you where the bright spots on the trail are. I can show you the scenic overlooks. It'll transform your life. And that's what he's done for me. And that's what the job of the sponsor is, I believe. The only job that I really feel like I'm obligated to do when someone asks me to sponsor them is to take their hand and guide them down the path of the 12 steps of the program of recovery. If something else happens, if a friendship develops, if whatever else happens, that's a bonus. But my job is to take them down the path of recovery. Help them avoid the pitfalls if I can, and to show them the beautiful scenery that God's placed along the way. I stood with this man who's close enough in age to be my grandfather. Pretty close. Not far off. And I had just got done telling him exactly who I was in the fifth step. And I was sober about 4 months. By now, most of the paralysis had gone away. Most of us get restored physically first anyway. But what had happened, and what happened on that day at a retreat, first one I'd ever been to, overlooking the Severn River, beautiful day like today, cool, breezy, sunny. And I just shared with him exactly who I was. And at the end of it all, the tough, strong guy that I tried to bring here to you, he was still around. I was still trying to hold up that image even though I was all busted up. By the end of that, my shoulders were slumped. The tears were just streaming down my face. And I was empty. Whew. There it is. Here's who I am. And I waited. I waited for the reaction. I waited for what will happen next. I've been as fearless and thorough as I could. I know I have to be. Like Tom said last night, I don't have another idea. This is it. This is my last shot. God, please help me be fearless and thorough. And I begged him to help me. And I had just given it all to this guy. And he looked at me, and a couple of tears running down his cheek. And he reached up and he put his arms around me. And he told me that God loved me a great deal, and so did he. And he said, "Welcome to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." And there was something magic about that moment. It took a couple weeks. I mean, I knew something had happened, and I felt glad and relieved for having walked through that, because I knew that by walking through the things that I was afraid of with your hand, that when I came out on the other side, I would be better for it. And you know how I knew? Because I watched the guys that had 3 months more than me go through it. They were the powerhouse. When I was new in sobriety, I couldn't imagine my sponsors 9 years. But I could watch what happened to the guy with 3 months when he took his fifth step. I could see him transfer. I could see the light come on in their eyes. And I couldn't deny it. So it was a combination. The reason I went through the step, there was a combination of fear that I'm going to drink and die, but also the hope of watching people who were just a little bit ahead of me, seeing what they got and the results. There was power in that. There is power in that. You know? And I walked away from that a different man. And I really felt like, for the first time when I sat in those chairs with you, it really, if you knew who I was, you'd let me stay. You'd let me stay. You know? What's happened? I'm going to tell you about some things in sobriety real quick, and then I'll end. First year, I had a girlfriend when I came here, and she left. One of the things that I talk to a lot of young guys in Alcoholics Anonymous about is trying to be single in AA. One of the greatest gifts that I've been given, and it took a while, was to have that time. You know, I spent 4 years single in Alcoholics Anonymous. Spent 4 years dating. Spent 4 years getting my feelings hurt. Spent 4 years trying to live by principles with unprincipled people. And I told my sponsor, at the end of this 4 years of experience and having amassed this wealth of experience with the opposite sex, I had come to a profound conclusion. And the conclusion was this. I told him, I am not going to practice principles with women anymore. It doesn't work. And he said to me what I sort of suspected was true. He said to me, "Dave," he said, "you don't have to. Of course, you'll drink and die." He said, "But let me tell you something." He said, let me tell you what will happen. He said, "Son," he said, "these last 4 years have been a training ground for you." And he said, "And if you really keep focused on what God wants you to do," he says, "I believe God has someone out there for you. And what these last 4 years have been a training ground so that when that person is placed in your life, you will appreciate her, you will love her, and you won't run her out." You know? And it wasn't too much after that that I was sitting in a meeting and, kind of looking around. I happened to notice this cute little brunette that I hadn't seen before in AA. You know? And she was talking to a friend of mine after the meeting. And I later found out it was her sponsor, and so I kind of went up and butted into the conversation, and I met my now wife. And if you're out there and you're playing the single game and you're wondering what's going on, you know, what's God want for you, what's His will? A friend of mine told me once that God doesn't want you to settle. God doesn't want you to settle. And there were many times when I wondered if I was being too picky and too choosy. And I'd have someone I was dating who had not all the characteristics that I would like to have had, but had some of them. You know, and then I'd kind of rearrange his characteristics and pick some others and see how that blend went. And what happened for me is I met my wife. We went out on our first date, and I knew she was it. I knew God didn't want me to settle. That was 5 years ago. The grandfather to held my hand watching me die in the hospital bed stood up for me as my best man in my wedding. They're precious memories. you all have given me. We're getting ready to walk out onto the altar. I feel a hand on my shoulder. And I look over into his eyes, and there's very, very, very rare tears trickling down his cheek. And he tells me how honored he is that I chose him to be my best. How honored he is. I've been with you 5 years and gone from laying in the bed dying, gone from the look of disgust in their eyes when I passed him as I was coming in drunk while he was on his way to work, to him being honored that I chose him. You can't buy it. You really can't earn it. Not 4 years. It's a gift. It's a gift that I've gotten as a byproduct. It's just showing up here wanting to do some very simple things. You know, one of the other things a lot of people struggle with is, you know, we all get sober, especially younger people, and they want to get their lives in order. And there's a couple things they always want to do. One is they want to get their relationships back together. I've touched on that. The other is they want to get back in shape. Okay? We won't go there. The third thing is they want to go back to school. They want to go back to school and finish their education. I had quit before I failed out of several universities. That was the way I did things. I hated to fail, so I quit before I failed out. Let me just tell you a quick story about the power of alcohol. And I was sober about 3 or 4 months. It wasn't long after we had done that fourth and fifth step, and my sponsor said, so what are you going to do now? I was like, I don't know. You know, I mean, I just got unparalyzed, you know. I thought I'd just go to 3 meetings a day the rest of my life and live off my grandparents. He told me that wasn't a spiritual principle. There's a seventh tradition around here that I could apply personally to my life. He said, why don't you go back to school? And I said, I can't do that. He said, you know, I got some severe, I got some severe brain damage, man. I mean, the whole side of my head's been smashed. I can't tell you what a paragraph says after I read it. He says, what else are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, this time you go back to school. You get on your knees in the morning. You ask that same God who you've been praying to for sobriety to help you with life. And he said, and this time you fail. You'll either pass or you'll fail. No quitting in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that I hated worst about my alcoholism, it made me quit. I wasn't a quitter until my alcoholism caught up with me. I hated being a quitter. And so I went back to that university, and I was about to take my midterms. And I knew I was going to fail every class. I knew it. I could feel it. Just done it. I went and, you know, you structure the argument with your sponsor. to try to get the answer you want, you make it sound a little worse than it is. You make your part sound like it's a little less, you know, so you're really a victim. And he wasn't hearing about it. He wasn't hearing it. He said, you don't quit. He said, what'd I tell you? He said, this time be a man and fail. Be a man and fail. See, we're not little boys and girls that run away to take our ball home anymore. He said, we're men and women. Stand up like God's kids. You know, you either make it or you won't, you know. And I made it. I made it that semester. And I thought, well, it's a fluke. You get those flukes, you know. Every now and then it's a fluke. And I started back the next semester, and you know what? There was a little less fear. And I made it that semester. A little less fear. After going back to that university, I got to stand up on a stage and get a piece of paper. And just like everything that you all have given me, everything that God has given me, he doesn't just let me skate by. You know, he raises us up as an example, I believe, of what he can do. And I got to graduate, the outstanding graduating senior. And the university that I had been on academic probation when I went back to said, we'd like you to stay and do some graduate work, and we'll pay you to do it. And, okay? What else do I got to do? What's in front of me? But of course I figured I wasn't going to be able to do that. But you all have given me a God. And when I'm afraid, I just take God's hand. And we walk through this here together. And a couple, year and a half later, I got another piece of paper. And they said, hey, you're here. You know, Why don't you stay and just finish everything off? 5 years. Wanted to quit the PhD so many times. God, it took everything I had, and I couldn't do it. Took everything I had, and it wasn't enough. And you all taught me that when I give everything I have, and it's not enough, that I get on my knees and I ask God to help me. And I'm here to report that I was ready to quit. My sponsor told me I don't get to quit. You fail, or you make it. And I got down on my knees, and I started asking that God again, give me whatever it takes to help me get through this. And a couple years ago, I stood on the stage, and a man slid a little hood over my head, and they called me doctor. And I'm not bragging on me. I'm bragging on the power that lies here. To take a guy laying in a hospital bed, more dead than alive, paralyzed with absolutely nothing left, physically, mentally, or spiritually, and 10 years later to put him standing up here at this podium with 3 college degrees, a beautiful wife, a beautiful little girl, a happy home filled with love, surrounded by people. I can't tell you how many people as I look out into this crowd have touched my life and have allowed me to touch theirs, that I'm just surrounded by the love that you have given me. I can't share it all. Not in an hour. And you've allowed me to come into your life. Sat in my home with me, you've eaten dinner at the table with me, you've stood with me at my wedding, you've stood with me when I've cried, you've been there and had your hand on my shoulder as I've buried people I love, for that is life. No one promised us that we wouldn't experience life that everybody else experiences, but what you've promised me is no matter what happens on the outside, that God is enough, and that God and you can carry me through it. And it really does seem like I've been given so much. And I guess I'll just close with a story that I like. And I forget where I read it. It's one of these spiritual books that, you know, some of these sponsors they give you every now and again. You know, he told me to stick with this one, but he even tells you in here, you know, if you want to enlarge on your concept of God, just go out there and search. And I've done some searching. And in this book, it tells a story of a woman who needed to find God and searched everywhere, spent hours upon hours in the stained glass windows, in the steeples, and spent hours talking to people who had degrees in theology, spent hours upon hours and years reading all the written words that are set down in the countless books about the subject of God. In the end of it all, she had not found him. In her desperation, she ran out into the woods and screamed to him, if there is a God, show yourself to me. She said that she fell to her knees and began to cry. And she heard a voice say, act as if I were, and you shall know that I am. I came here not believing. I came here not believing that God would be able to do for me what I needed done. I came here with nothing. And what you all have done is said, follow us. Do the things we do. And you will know God's love. And today, standing up here with you, I know God's love. And if there's anything that I want for you today, it's that maybe, just maybe, that you get to feel it too. Thanks for having me.